Back in October, we had a conversation with a children's book author, Kansas City native Derek Barnes. He talked about the feeling of sitting at a barbershop and getting a fresh new cut. That feeling inspired him to write Crown, an ode to the fresh cut. Since then, the book has raked in awards. It was just named a Newbery Honor Book, Caldecott Honor Book, a Coretta Scott King Honor Book. It even won an Ezra Jack Keats Book Award for New Writers. Here on KCUR's Central Standard, we're celebrating the book's success by listening back to that conversation. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Derek Barnes, good morning. Welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Gina.
Your book, can I start not at the beginning? I want to start at the end. Because at the end, on the last page, you write this story, your own personal story, memories of riding the bus to get your own haircuts at the barbershop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, my mother worked a lot. She was a CNA nurse, and she always left dinner for us, you know, in the evening. And on Thursdays, she left $8 on the coffee table because when I was in the sixth grade, I was able to ride the bus and, you know, go get my hair cut. I would either go on Thursdays or go on Saturdays. So I ride the bus to Jesse's. It's on, I think, 57th or 59th and Prospect. And my barber's name was Mr. Tony, and he's still there today. And man, to get my hair cut on Thursday means that when I showed up to school on Friday, I would look so fresh and people would pay attention to me and I felt smarter. And my girlfriend thought I was the most handsome boy in the entire school. I mean, this was all in my head, you know what I mean? But I just felt better about myself. And you know, that it just brought back memories when I saw a sketch of a friend of mine. He sketched his teenage son after he came back from the barbershop, and it brought back all those memories.
When you're referencing a sketch that you saw that inspired you to write a children's book, can you tell me what made you think that this memory and this feeling, the barbershop feeling, was good, like, material for a children's story?
I've traveled a lot, especially since I guess 2008 when my first books came out, and I always make it a point. Most of the schools that I go to are in an urban environment, and I like to get out into the community. So that means I go to the stores, I go to the restaurants, and I go to the barbershops. You know, I like to always talk about one of the special gifts that creative people have. You know, most of us are introverts, but a lot of the gifts that we have is to absorb our environment and be able to regurgitate those things out, you know, on in them stories and onto pages. And it doesn't matter what city I've gone to, you know, Oakland, Brooklyn, Miami, you know, Chicago, it's the same setting. You know, you have people bringing their young boys into a barbershop, and you know, the conversations are all the same. We're talking about politics, we're talking about sports, we're talking about women. And you have boys there, you know, lined up, you know, wanting to get that new, fresh haircut. And it's the same feeling. You know, you see the smiles on their faces. I see them looking like royalty. I mentioned, I think, in the author's note, that I think the Black barbershop is the only place in America where Black boys can go to get tended to get, you know, treated like royalty, I guess. And I think that's how I came up with the title.
I read the book actually a couple of times. I think it's what really stands out to me is the sweetness of the book.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's I guess it made me think about the fact that people don't usually acknowledge that boys care what they look like or yeah. want to be taken care of. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You know, with all of my projects, I really try to focus on the humanity. I feel like I have an obligation. I have four sons, ages 6, 11, 13, 16. And I feel like we all have a a social obligation, but I feel like my obligation as an African American male author, that's a father and a husband, is to depict African American children as human. You know, when you look at popular culture, when you look at hip hop videos, when you look at movies, when you see the news every night, I feel like we haven't been depicted historically in the most positive light. So, I mean, I live with four beautiful human beings, and I just feel like it's my job to show their human side, you know, show how smart they are, how funny they are, how optimistic they are about their future. And so I try to do that in every single book that I write, every single story that I write, you know. So I felt like this was an opportunity, you know. I took my boys to Tony when I lived in Kansas City, but we live in Charlotte now. We've been in Charlotte for 3 years now. I found a barber shop for them here, and it's the same experience, you know. You know, just about self-affirmation and feeling good about yourself when you look into the mirror. And I just wanted to share that side of being boys, you know, in particular African-American boys.
You also have you as the author are speaking to a young boy who's going to get his hair cut. And yeah, one of the things you talk to this young reader about, the observation of grown men sitting in the barber shop too, like that this is a place where these young boys are going to see grown men, and that that's going to mean something to them. Who are the characters you decided to populate this barbershop with, and why?
I mean, if you go to any black barbershop in America, you are likely to see a cross of everybody from, the socioeconomic ladder. You might see a surgeon in there. You might see a guy that owns his own lawn care business. There are college students, there are fathers, there are grandfathers. So you have this whole plethora and mixing of black men that come from all walks of life, you know. And a lot of the characters that I put in the book are just, you know, people that I remember from my past, people from the neighborhood, people that I looked up to. You know, there were a few teachers that came to my barbershop. And to just be a fly on the wall, to be 11 years old and hear these black men talk about real life issues. I mean, you know, that's really the only place where you hear the convening of all these beautiful and brilliant ideas as a boy. You also learn how to communicate, how to debate back and forth, you know, with confidence and with swagger.
Do you remember?
Intelligence. Yeah.
Do you remember a conversation that you heard as a child in a barbershop at Tony's that really left an impression on you enough that you remember it today?
Yeah, one, I remember being 11, and, you know, like I said, I had a little girlfriend, but there was an older gentleman. He had to be in his late 60s, early 70s, and he was getting his hair cut, and there were young men, and maybe in their 20s, going back and forth about how many girlfriends they had, and you know, just kind of boasting and bragging. And I remember the older gentleman asking either one of them if they were in school. They both said no. Asking both of them if they were employed, and they both said no. And this was the first time I heard this phrase, you know, no romance without finance is a damn nuisance, you know. So you just hear phrases like that all the time, how important it was to be a man, you know, the exact definition of what it really meant to be a man, you know, to have his own, to have employment, to have his own house. You know, I'm 11 years old learning these things, you know, about what it actually means to be a man. And sometimes in our community, you don't get these things at home. I didn't have a father at home. So when I went to the barbershop and I was around, you know, all those black men, it was a great experience for me. I got my hair cut a lot, twice a week, you know, and a lot of times I didn't even need a haircut. I just wanted to go to the shop, you know.
There's a word that you used a minute ago, swagger, and you use it a lot in the book too.
Yeah, it's swagger. It's just it's just that confidence that we have. You know, we talk about, you know, that walk that a confident black man has when his head is up high when he enters a room. These are things that come naturally, and a lot of things that my sons may, you know, may pick up from me, I picked up from my uncles, you know. And I think it's important, you know, because I see a lot of characters in middle school novels who are very self-deprecating, and that just hasn't been our experience, you know.
So
We
like
always have
teaching the
comfort.
lessons of humility or something like that.
Yeah, I mean that's important to have, to be humble, but also make sure that you are informed, that you are being compassionate, but at the same time, make sure that people know that you are the man. I mean, that's just something that we witness, that we see growing up, you know, in our communities, in our households, that it's all right to have confidence, you know, but not be a jerk with it, you know what I mean? So.
Is that something, I mean, you mentioned having four sons. Is that a fine line that you think it's challenging to show someone?
Yeah, raising four African American boys is no easy feat, especially in the current climate that we're in right now. But you know, it's my wife's job to worry about them. You know, she constantly worries about them when they go out, and I don't have any worries about them. I always make sure that I instill confidence in them. And make sure that they keep their head up high. I teach them how to interact with men, regardless of their age or or race. You make sure that they know that after they meet you, you know, the strong handshake, and a stance. It's a daily tutorial about how to put your best face forward and go out to the world. And you know, we have a phrase around here: difference makers. You know, all four of them. You're gonna go out into the world and be a difference maker, you know.
On near the very end of this book, after the boy who's on the cover gets his hair cut, you have him paying the barber, and it says, "You'll put the money in his hand without even expecting change back. Tip that man, tip that man. It was worth it. It always is."
Yeah, I got that phrase from Deion Sanders. He's a Hall of Fame football player. And anytime a athlete's contract is up, you know, he always uses a phrase, "Pay that man, pay that man." So I feel like, you know, barbers are a key institution in the African American community, you know. And anytime I've ever gone to the barbershop, and my older brothers always taught me this about, you know, making sure that you tip these guys, because they're not only barbers, but a lot of them are, you know, counselors, you know, in a sense. A lot of them do wonders for your, you know, confidence. You know, you may be having a horrible day, and go in and speak to your barber, and he makes everything all right. And not just with the haircut, but the conversation and the whole feel in the barbershop. So always make sure I tip those guys, no matter how. I think I've been tipping them ever since I was 11, you know.
This, the exchange, like this mutual exchange of caring, I think is the sweetness that I was picking up on in the book, that it goes both directions, that they're the grown men really nurturing these young boys and in a very hands-on way, which I think the stereotype in our society is that so much of the hands-on nurturing for children is that that's this feminine role. And the barber seems like this kind of beautiful exception to that. Can you talk to me about that?
I think they realize that these young boys are an extension of themselves, not just as a barber, but as fathers, uncles, grandfathers, they are reflections. I feel that way about my sons. I always want to make sure that they put their best foot forward. Making sure that their hair is cut, making sure that they are dressed, properly, that they smell good. Even my 10-year-old, he makes sure he wears his cologne before he heads off to school in the morning, and they all do. But I think it's our obligation to make sure that our boys go out into the world and they are a proper representation of who we are as men. And it doesn't have to always come from a family member, that we take the responsibility, to be leaders, to be mentors, to make sure that these boys go out and do their best job in school, in relationships. It's our responsibility. Going back to what I was saying before, it's our responsibility to make sure that the young men in our lives, and it's not even just my sons. My sons have tons of friends that come over, and I make sure that I treat them just like they were honorary Barnes brothers. That I want to make sure that I pour into them, and I saw this at the barbershop, that these men were pouring into, boys that, weren't even related to them, because I think it's just love. It's love of the community. They know that these boys are going to grow up to be fathers and, husbands one day. At least that's the expectation.
I know you're not the illustrator of this book, but there's something I have noticed about the way that the boys are always holding themselves. It's with the chin just slightly up and a smile.
Yeah.
Does that positioning, does that impression mean anything to you?
Well, first of all, shout out to Gordon James. That's my brother from another mother. I met him while I was a copywriter at Hallmark Cards, and we've never done a project together. And we finally have, and it looks like we have something on our hands. But we did a photo shoot with my 11-year-old Silas. And Silas is very cocky, and some would say overly arrogant. And Silas always keeps his chin up. Gordon did an absolute perfect job. I gave him a photo of Silas with his chin up and his eyes, kind of slanted, looking very cocky.
Yeah, looking a
And
little bit down. But I didn't
yes.
say the illustrations anyway. It doesn't look cocky. It looks, I don't know, like a child who's pleased.
Yeah, that's him. The cover is Silas, and we had a photo shoot. Gordon took like maybe 30 or 40 pictures of Silas just in different poses. We actually went to a barber shop. He got his hair cut, and Gordon was shooting away, and he ended up with these beautiful illustrations. So Silas feels like a celebrity. He's going to be coming on tour with us and maybe sign a few books,
That's
so
awesome.
yeah.
Derek Barnes, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Gina. I appreciate it.
Derek's book is called Crown, An Ode to the Fresh Cut. Up next, we'll turn to KCUR's Brian Ellison for a conversation about the little-told story of African American migration in rural Midwestern communities. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now returning back to a conversation that aired in September of 2016 about Black families who moved into Kansas and the Midwest right after the Civil War. The show was hosted by Brian Ellison, and it starts with a story.
I was in the kitchen when I hears it, the cry. My
That's
back
Crystal
home street
Bradshaw, reading from a book
cries.
she's written in the voice of an ancestor.
I was imagining the eyes look like a mama hen with her feathers all ruffled up, but I ain't thinking about being no chicken when I sees Joe standing over my babies, John clutching on Granville, both crying, calling me. Mama, mama, you better get quick, boy, before I give you something to cry about. What you think you be doing? Joe turned around so quick it take a moment for the rest of his body to catch up with his nasty self.
Growing up in Jetmore, Kansas, a town of about 900 people not too far from Dodge City, Crystal had a happy childhood, but always felt something was missing. I'm Brian Ellison. Today on KCUR Central Standard, we're digging into the story of African-American migration after the Civil War. A lot of people don't realize that while many former slaves moved north, thousands moved west to Kansas, to towns like Jetmore, and set up farms and rural towns with their newfound freedom. We're starting that conversation today by hearing more about what happened when Crystal began digging into and writing about her own family's history. KCUR's CJ Janovy has more.
Crystal Bradshaw's great-great-great-great-great-grandmother was born a slave in Kentucky.
Lord, Lord, please help me, please help me. Numb, crack. I sees it, but it ain't connecting with my head what happened. Crack, crack, crack. I scream and blood running down over my eyes, blinding me, stinging me.
Bradshaw published her book about her five times great-grandmother Eliza a year ago. It came in response to her feelings in high school, which wasn't that long ago, where students did genealogy projects.
We'd have to get up in front of the class and present our family history, which sounds easy enough.
She comes from a diverse family.
I have like cousins who are Chinese, Hispanic, there's Native American, white passing, all these different things. So whenever we have big family gatherings, there's literally kids of like all phenotypes just running around.
Her mother's side of the family kept good records.
But on my father's side of the family, there was very limited information.
One year for school, she really wanted to talk about her dad's side. When it was her turn, all she could say was that her great-grandfather was a stonemason. She sat back down and everyone looked at her weird.
It was just embarrassing in a sense because so many of the different students knew their family history, like actually where they came from.
Bradshaw kept digging but found nothing on Ancestry.com. A few screens into Google, she hit pay dirt, a paper written back in the early 1900s by a distant, distant cousin. It was published a few years ago by a history professor at Emporia State University. And it told the story of Eliza.
Her and her family, so her husband and her children, were emancipated in 1865. And they tried living in Lexington, Kentucky, which is where they were previously enslaved. But things were really bad for them. A lot of African Americans were dying and different things like that from the KKK.
So Eliza's family joined the great migration of former slaves to homesteads in Kansas. They called themselves Exodusters. The Bradshaws arrived in 1879.
I actually do remember seeing Eliza's tombstone when I was little. It said Eliza Bradshaw on it. Like, it's an old-looking tombstone, so I said, Grandma, like, who's this? And she was like, I don't know. So it's just amazing because we literally were walking on the soil where our ancestors were buried, not having any idea or having any context of like who these people were and the life struggles.
The industrious Bradshaw decided to flesh out the story of those struggles. She did more research, and by the time she got to college at the University of Kansas, she had written a fictionalized account of Eliza's story.
Crystal was a freshman.
KU English professor Mary Emma Graham is the director of the Project on the History of Black Writing.
The graduate students found this just absolutely amazing that a freshman could start a life in college with a book that she was intent on publishing because she'd been doing all the research.
Bradshaw self-published her book. She wanted complete control over the work. She didn't want a publisher changing its name or its cover art or the unique dialect in which she'd written it.
You better get quick, boy, before I give you something to cry about. What you think you be doing? Joe turned around so quick it'd take a moment for the rest of his body to catch up with his nasty self.
Crystal does not speak vernacular Black English. Her parents don't speak vernacular Black English. So I think that the choice to write in the vernacular was a challenge because you have to create something that you don't know.
I was hearing this voice, and it was Grandma Eliza's voice the whole time while I was writing it, helping me visualize like what things were going on.
The process was often an emotional one for Bradshaw.
Just because some of the stuff, or a lot of the stuff that slaves had to deal with at that time was just very, very hard. Like, I don't know how they live through stuff like that.
Things were rough for the family after they got to Kansas, too. Eliza's husband and two of her children died. Bradshaw wondered why she stayed.
I probably honestly would have left. I'm like, this place is awful. But, you know, she saw some good somewhere, and I definitely see the good now in Jetmore, so I'm glad that she stayed.
So is Mary Emma Graham of KU's History of Black Writing Project.
The Black Exoduster experience is one that we know far too little about.
So Bradshaw's book, she says, is a gift to Kansas and to the whole Midwest.
We need to keep an eye on her.
After all, Crystal Bradshaw hasn't even graduated from college yet. She just started her senior year.
That was KCUR's CJ Janovy. Crystal Bradshaw's family was just one of thousands of families to make the migration to Kansas. Janella Holmes' family was another. Not too long ago, after years teaching at Kansas State University, Janella moved back to her ancestral home of Nicodemus, Kansas. And that's where she is this morning, joining us by Skype. Janella, good morning.
Good morning.
Where is Nicodemus anyway?
Oh, man, it's the epic center of the United States, almost.
Is it? It seems like it's a little ways from here.
Right. It's north of it's north by 2 hours from Dodge City, 1 hour from Hayes, snuggled right in between on Highway 24 between Hill City, Kansas, and Stockton.
So that gives us a good sense of it. How many people live there these days?
Actually, right now on the town site, and you'll hear me interchange the words town site and township. The town site is 161 acres. It's what is declared the National Historic Site. And on there, there's about 19 of us that actually live on the town site. Now, within the township and farming in those areas, we have an additional 45.
So let's see, that adds up to 64 or so people.
Yeah, 64, 65.
How about when it was founded back in 1877? How many people would have been there then?
Well, the first set of families to come in 1877 were led by a white man named W.R. Hill, and then five ministers that used to be Buffalo soldiers and had retired in the area. They went to Kentucky to solicit these people to come. And that's my connection to Miss Bradshaw's book and her story, because they were part of that. Now, we're pre-Exodus, and there were about 300 people to come and settle September 17th of 1877.
And I want to talk about the Exodusters in a, mm-hmm. in a little bit here, but tell me more about this group that was led by W.R. Hill and some others to come out. Where'd they come from?
They mainly came from Georgetown, Kentucky. That's another connection with Miss Bradshaw. And Scott County, Kentucky. And then there were some that were from Tennessee and a few from Mississippi. They saw the flyer that said that you could go west and own your own land, and it was the land of milk and honey. Hmm. And if you know anything about the Bible, it often talks of milk and honey, so who wouldn't want to come then?
What was it, in fact, a land of milk and honey when they got there?
Not at all. they were tricked.
What did they find?
Well, they found that there were no trees. And so they couldn't really build anything, that they actually had to live in dugouts. W.R. Hill, he was just very eloquent in telling them that you'll be able to just throw your seeds on the ground and they'll grow. Not so much.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some deception, but they were brilliant men that knew that if they brought blacks out, had blacks create their own town, then he could populate the county and have his own town of Hill City. And so they were brilliant in that.
Brilliant, if a little bit self-serving.
Yeah, very much so.
Why? What was the appeal besides the promise of land? Why not stay in Georgetown, Kentucky, and make a life there?
Well, you could only share crop. You couldn't own land. There were a lot of Jim Crow laws that prohibited assembling, being out on your porch after dark, and just doing some things like that. They were not prospering at all through sharecropping. And so these brilliant people, they decided that going and having their own land and being self-governed was more important to them than staying in the South. And so they took that chance, sight unseen, to come to Kansas. And it paid off very well in the beginning.
Yeah, how many people did this, would you estimate?
There were 300 that was in the first group that came September of 1877. And then there was another group, a large group of about 150 that came that following spring.
And that was just Nicodemus.
Right. That was just Nicodemus. And, you know, we were considered an example also. What we were just in reports, and people all over the nation were talking about Nicodemus being an all-Black community and whether or not they could survive and whether or not they had the fortitude to really build their own town. Could Blacks do this? We know whites can do it, but can Blacks? So it became an example for the nation on whether or not Blacks could really govern themselves and have their own farms and their schools and that sort of thing. So, we were pre-Exodus, but we were the example that Pap Singleton, who is noted for leading most of the Exodusters to Kansas, we were their example of how to create their own town and how to be self-governed.
I want to talk more about your family and the town of Nicodemus, but you've mentioned the Exodusters a couple times here. Tell us what that is. What was this Exoduster movement?
The Exoduster movement was, again, led by Pap Singleton, a brilliant man, an ex-slave that knew that Blacks needed to get out of the South. And so that's what the name of that migration of people became, the Exodus movement.
Just like the Exodus in the Bible.
Right, in the Bible.
And where did they go besides Kansas?
Oh, Oklahoma. They later went to Oklahoma, like Boley, Oklahoma was established in 1907. And that's why Nicodemus is considered the epic township, because we were established almost 30 years before. We're self-governed, of course. I keep repeating myself, and I'm sorry about that, but I'm just so excited about what my ancestors were able to do. In those kind of towns, they grew. As far west as Colorado, which is Deerfield, no longer exists. There were noted 40 Black colonies in Kansas alone. We've only been historically able to identify about 23. And one of those areas, again, connects to Miss Bradshaw, started out in Hodgman. And now it's considered Hodgman County, which also has the township of Jetmore, where her family has one of the largest African-American farms in the nation.
So her family continues to be in farming and has contributed for more than a century now to the culture and the agriculture of the area.
Right. Absolutely.
What did your family do when they first came out to Nicodemus?
Nicodemus was and still is an agricultural-based community. And, my great-grandparents were part of those original settlers. I'm a fourth-generation descendant, and my great-grandmother, she was pregnant at the time of her move in 1877, and she is noted for having the first African-American born in Graham County.
Huh.
We are also in that group was a couple named Zach and Jenny Fletcher, and he became our postmaster. Jenny Fletcher, Mrs. Fletcher, became our school teacher. She started having school immediately that spring of 1878, and it was housed in her home.
And do you feel like you've known this history your whole life, or did you sort of have a process of coming to learn some of this?
I've known it, and it's been ingrained in me my entire life. My mother was one of those oral storytellers, and she could tell a story. And I actually, my father was from Mississippi, and he was working on the crew that helped to dig and develop Webster Lake. And his partner was killed in an accident, and they called over to Nicodemus to see if there was anyone that could come and sing at the graveside funeral. And my mother, who had a beautiful voice, was sent over. And while she's singing, it was told to me that he said, "That's going to be my wife." Thank goodness. And so my mom was already living here, had already established herself, and had kept the history going. And she just loved to tell those stories. And so I grew up not far from here, And then, of course, it was just ingrained with our celebration that we have every year, which is in its 138th year.
Well, I want to hear more about that celebration and about the different things that are still going on in the town of Nicodemus. But for now, let's take a break. And in a moment, we'll continue this conversation on KCUR Central Standard about African-American migration to Kansas almost a century and a half ago. We'll look at what led to the decline of many of these towns, and we'll hear how some of them are hanging on or coming back and about their lasting impact on the state. I'm Brian Ellison. Stay with us. It's KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking today about black migration to rural Kansas after the Civil War and the lasting impact that has had. Jonella Holmes is a retired K-State professor who's moved back to the town her ancestors helped start in 1877, Nicodemus, Kansas. She's joining us by Skype from there this morning. Jonella, Nicodemus is still there. It's not exactly a thriving metropolis. You mentioned that it's down to 19 people living in the few square blocks of the town. What happened exactly?
Well, our initial demise happened in 1888. We were told that the Union Pacific and other railroads were considering coming through this way. And, you know, back then that was the transportation. If your town was lucky enough to get the railroad, you became a hub. You continued to thrive. Union Pacific had asked us about land and also if we could get a $18,000 bond together. And those amazing, amazing people in 1888 were able to do so. They got the money together. They got the bond established. They had the land outlined.
So the people had to raise their own bond to get the train to come to their town?
Absolutely. Huh. Absolutely.
And they did it.
They did it. I don't think I could raise $18,000.
And that $18,000 was quite a lot more of a task then.
But exactly.
But even so, the train didn't come.
No, it didn't. They decided to go 5 miles south, and that established some towns like Zurich and DeMar and Bogue. They became more thriving towns. And of course, at that time, we had two livery stables, general stores, four churches and a post office and banks and two newspapers. So we were really at that, you know, that center of really establishing ourselves and being a thriving town. And those businesses had to move to where the railroad. But there were families that hung on and they said, this is our land. We've stayed here. We've homesteaded and we're not going anywhere. And one of the reasons that Nicodemus survived even losing the opportunity to have a railroad was because we had established an annual celebration, a 3-day event that mirrored the one that they did back in Kentucky. Because we were able to trace our lineage back to Richard M. Johnson's plantation, where a huge number of those African Americans came from. He was actually vice president under Van Buren. So our history is rich. And so we kept that 3-day colors fair, colored people's fair, and we established our own once we were here in Nicodemus. And that celebration still goes on to today.
Has it gone on every year without interruption all that time?
Every single year. It has it's never missed a year.
There can't be too many festivals like that. I want to ask about that festival, but I guess, going back to that demise, you said the demise started in 1888, but your family stayed there for a long time after that. What were the people who were still there doing? How was the town sustaining itself?
Well, by that time, they had established pretty large plots of land. And so they were farming. They were doing some things like that, really adding to the economic base of the county and doing some things like that. And so pretty much there's one farmer, Gil Alexander of the Alexander family. He still today farms land that was purchased and homesteaded in 1878.
Hmm.
He's one of our largest farmers. And so that's pretty much what happened. We didn't lose our post office until the 1950s. And we also did not lose our elementary school until the mid-1960s. So we still had a town that was going on. We had restaurants here. 160 people were still around in the mid-1960s, so we hung on as long as possible.
You mentioned that there were dozens of towns like Nicodemus at one point. Did similar declines happen in all of those other towns, or did other towns have manage to survive and continue to thrive?
They did not manage. We're the only and the oldest in Kansas that's still in existence. Let me give you an example of Council Grove. Outside of Council Grove, there was a town called Dunlap, and that's one that Pap Singleton was really noted for establishing. Well, there's only a few cornerstones of buildings that are left there. One thing, they didn't get good land like we did here in Nicodemus, so farming was almost impossible. And there were other reasons. They didn't establish that nucleus that would hold them together and keep the families coming. Even when families left Nicodemus in large groups in the 50s and the 60s, because agriculture had just become really difficult through the drought years, we still had that celebration. Mm-hmm. And so people would make sure that no matter where they lived in California, in Ontario, Canada, that they would take their vacation, and it became affectionately known as homecoming. And
tell me about homecoming. I mean, you said there's 19 people in the town, in the township. You may add that in and you get about 64. How many people come back for homecoming every year?
Our lowest number a couple of years ago was about 350, but we can usually count on between 500 and 700 people to come back for the celebration.
So I'm guessing there are not hotels just standing around in Nicodemus. Where do all these people go?
Well, some that still have their homesteads, they open up their homes and that sort of thing. I had 19 people staying in my house this year alone.
Is that a bed and breakfast? Do you you feed all those people too, Johnella?
No, we have vendors.
Oh, okay. Very good.
So I encourage them to go to the vendors and that sort of thing. But, you know, they stay in Stockton, Kansas Hill City, as far away as Hayes and that sort of thing. And then, you know, commute during the day and for the festivities.
And what happens at these festivities?
Well, we usually start on Friday and we do a meet and greet and try to reestablish your lineage. We think it's very important. Angela Bates, who actually was the catalyst for us becoming a National Historic Site, does genealogies, and then we connect and we can see that lineage, and actually she has the Historical Society. And so we do that on Friday afternoons, and then that evening we have our first dance. Saturday is our more educational day, and we start off with the Kansas Black Farmers Association has a free pancake, because we do farm our wheat, send our wheat to Utah, and then they develop at Lehigh a pancake mix. And so we have the pancake, free pancake breakfast on Saturday mornings, our educational programs, parade. It's just a day full of activities, and then we end that evening with, some can go to a gospel extravaganza, or you can go back to the dance. And then Sunday we accumulate the weekend with a church service that you can attend or not, and then a community picnic to say goodbye.
Why'd you move back there, Johnella?
I had to. You're going to make me cry.
It's all right.
I had to. We started a summer camp program, and we bring kids out here, and I have them go to K-State for 2 days, and then we finish the week out here teaching them to horseback ride and to swim and to hike and stargaze and find out the importance and immerse themselves in an actual working farm and that sort of thing. And that was just not enough for me to do it from Manhattan. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine.
In order for us to continue to live, the Park Service is amazing, and we wouldn't be where we're at without the Park Service. But they needed foot soldiers, and that's what I consider myself. And I you know, with me comes my extended family, and my daughter decided to bring her husband and family out. And so I think in these small ways, if I can encourage and let them see that it's time to move home and to keep our town going, then that's what I was put on this earth to do.
You're mentioning the Park Service, and of course you mentioned that the town became a National Historic Site a few years ago. What does that mean for the town? It sounds a little bit like you're both living there, but you're also living in a museum in a certain way.
And I absolutely am. And that's what's so phenomenal. We're unlike the Dead President's House or, you know, Yellowstone. We're unlike those parks because we're a living, breathing history. You know, you can come back and there's programming that we do, and I dress up and do reenactments of my great-grandmother. So you can actually see the history and feel the history. And with the Park Service, we'll never die. That was legislation. Bill Clinton signed it into law. So we will always be here because of the Park Service. But we don't want those park guides to be the main story. We want descendants and families and those connected to Nicodemus to be the story when you come to Nicodemus.
How important would you say, from what you have studied this history more than most people, how important were these African-American communities, and especially the farmers who came to Kansas, as it affected the development of agriculture in the state through the last century?
In the 1800s, it was vital. African-Americans establishing themselves and then farming was a great economic base. It was something that no one really looks at or would put in the history books or was held accountable for, but they were a strong economic base. I mean, like the Bradshaws, at one point in the early 1900s, they had over 8,000 acres. They've retained 4,000. And when you're a farmer at that magnitude, you know, you're feeding a lot of people. You're employing a lot of people. You know, and some of that has, of course, gone down with the older generations and our kids moving away and that sort of thing. But economically, we were a force to be reckoned with.
And today, do you still see the impact of what a powerful force these communities once were?
I see the potential. I absolutely see the potential, and that's why it was important for us to establish the Kansas Black Farmers Association, the Nicodemus Flower Co-op, to try to reestablish that economic base. You know, that's why it's important now for us to continue to move forward, to hopefully some of these children that we bring out, excite them about farming to the point that we grow new farmers and we can continue to contribute. That's all we've ever wanted to do.
You know, listening to you, Janella, and just the little bit of reading I've done about this, I'm surprised by how little discussed this migration to Kansas and the Exoduster movement are. I think we all are pretty familiar with the movement north to the cities. but we don't hear that much about this move west. Why is that, do you think?
Well, I think it's because so many of the towns were, you know, they died out. Mm-hmm. And so where do you go back for that epic history? Where do you, you know, where you find in Dunlap, you can't, unless you're specifically going with someone that can guide you, you won't find it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
the whole town.
Yeah, the entire town. Jetmore has become a 98% white community. And so, you know. And it just, Angela, our executive director of the Nicodemus Historical Society, is going to the grand opening of the African American Museum on the Mall in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were consulted a little bit, and there's just a little bit of history. But what she wants to do is get in the ear of the director and let him know that they need to include this Western migration and how powerful it was.
What do you think happens next? I know you've worked hard. The National Historic Recognition is now there. You're trying to get people to come back. Do you think Nicodemus will grow?
I absolutely do. I absolutely do. I used to be at 60, the youngest resident here in Nicodemus, but we had one of our families move back, and she's actually 21 years old. So I no longer have that claim to fame. But if we can get, and I don't need you to live in Nicodemus. You can live in the surrounding areas and your kids can go to the schools in surrounding areas. But I need you to make a commitment to work here, to volunteer, to be, you know, part of what we're trying to develop.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was Brian Ellison back in September of 2016. That's it for our show today. You can find these conversations and everything you've heard on KCUR's Central Standard at kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, have you thought about starting a second or third career? We'll hear from a lawyer turned chocolatier. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Stay tuned. Thank you.